inside the old doghouse and I watch for a moment to see if he comes running back out. But he doesn't. I close the screen door, and then the back door, and lock the deadbolt. I'll return him to Pastor Brian in the morning. That is, if he doesn't figure out how to scale the backyard fence and get home on his own. I make myself a sandwich and turn on the TV, but by the time I'm done eating, I still haven't found anything interesting to watch. I slept so long tonight, I feel completely energized, and I'm hardly even thinking about Honor and her boyfriend. I decide to use my unusual burst of energy to clean my room. I pop in my headphones and start to clean, but it's surprising how many songs talk about forbidden love or kissing someone. I change the song every time my mind goes there in hopes it will spark an unrelated memory. I skip songs until I get to Ocean, and then I grab an old T-shirt to wipe down all my trophies. Every time I buy a new one, I dust them and rearrange them. The new bowling trophy I bought a couple of weeks ago will go front and center. I reach to the back of my shelf and grab the football trophy I stole from Drew Waldrop. I set it aside for when I change Jesus Christ's outfit later tonight. I spend the next several hours enjoying a house of solitude while everyone sleeps. I take an uninterrupted shower. I watch the first 10 minutes of 8 different shows on Netflix. I might have an issue with my attention span because I can never make it through an entire show without getting bored. I do 1.5 crossword puzzles before I get stumped on a 4-letter word for word. When I notice the first tease of sun shining through one of the stained glass windows, I decide to change Jesus Christ's clothes before anyone wakes up. I gather all the stuff I need. Once I have the ladder set up in the living room, I climb it with my stolen football trophy in hand. I slide the roll of tape off my wrist and place the trophy in Jesus' right hand, then secure it there with the tape. I readjust the cheese hat on top of his crown of thorns. When I finish, I descend the ladder and stand back to admire my creation. I normally give Jesus a temporary nickname, depending on the theme of his outfit. Last month, he was referred to as Holy Ghost, for obvious reasons. And now, considering he is currently dressed as a Packers fan, complete with a home team jersey, a Wisconsin cheese hat, and now Drew Waldrop's missing trophy, I think I shall deem him Jesus Christ. Dad and Victoria are going to be pissed when they see that. I turn around and a freshly showered and dressed Honor is staring up at Jesus. I smile because that's precisely why I went through all this effort. My father is a huge Cowboys fan, and he's been talking about tonight's game between Dallas and Green Bay incessantly. He's only going to be mad that I dressed him as a Packers fan. Victoria, on the other hand, will be mad that I dressed him at all. Unlike my father, Victoria believes in God, and Jesus, and the sanctity of religion. She hates it when I dress up Jesus. She says it's sacrilegious and disrespectful. I disagree. It would be disrespectful if the actual Jesus Christ were in our living room and I forced him to change clothes all the time, but this Jesus is fake, made out of wood and plastic. I tried to explain that to Victoria. I told her one of the 10 commandments is not to worship false idols. Dressing this idol of Jesus up for fun, that rather than worshiping it, is actually following the commandment. She didn't see it that way. But her opposition obviously hasn't persuaded me to stop. I grab the ladder and take it back to the garage. Dad should be waking up any minute now, so I get rid of the evidence, even though it's a given that I'm the only one in the house who makes an effort to dress Jesus Christ anymore. Honor hasn't seemed to care about eternal life since she became obsessed with the terminally ill a few years ago. Honor and I may look identical, sound identical, and share identical mannerisms, but we couldn't be more opposite. Most identical twins finish each other's sentences, know what each other is thinking, and share common interests. But Honor and I confuse the hell out of each other. We tried our best to live up to the identical twin standard, but once we hit puberty, we just kind of gave up. Then when she started dating Kirk, his death put an even bigger wedge between us, because up until that point, we had experienced almost everything together. But after Kirk died, she had experienced things I hadn't. Being in love, losing her virginity, experiencing grief. We no longer felt like we were on the same level after that. Or at least she felt she was on a different level than me, and the more time that passes, the more we drift apart. I walk back into the kitchen from the garage, and my steps falter at the sight of Sagan. His back is to me as he sits at our kitchen table, in our house, at a highly inappropriate time of day. Who visits their girlfriend at 7 in the morning? He's becoming a constant fixture in Dollar Voss, which makes me feel less and less envious of my sister every time he chooses to be here. Who in their right mind would willingly return to this house? Has he not met my family? Is he that blinded by his unrequited love for honor? He's hunched over, focused intently on his sketch pad in front of him. When I realized he was actually an artist, I laughed at my luck. I had hoped he was an artist right before he kissed me, but it's only fitting that the more I'm around him, the more perfect he seems. It's karma for being attracted to my twin sister's boyfriend. Moby walks into the kitchen and shuffles over to the table. Moby is quite possibly the only part of this family that brings me joy, but 4-year-olds are fairly liked across the board. There's still plenty of time for Moby to disappoint me.
Morning, buddy.
Sagan ruffles Moby's hair, but Moby is not a morning person, despite his age. He shifts his head away and climbs into the seat next to him. Sagan tears off a sheet of blank paper from the sketchbook he's been hunched over. He slides the piece of paper in front of Moby and plucks a crayon out of a basket in front of him, winning Moby over instantly. There isn't a 4-year-old on Earth who doesn't love a crayon and a sheet of paper. Moby is always trying to copy the things on her boyfriend sketches, which is humorous considering the morbid themes her boyfriend is always sketching. Just yesterday I found a picture he sketched of Honor. She was sitting in an empty grave, putting on lipstick. On the back he had written, "Till death do us part." I never know what any of his drawings mean, but they fascinate me. I just don't want him to know that. I also don't want him to know that every time he draws a sketch for Honor and she leaves it lying around like it doesn't even mean anything to her, I steal it. I have several of his drawings now, wrapped in a bathrobe and stuffed in the bottom of my dresser drawer. Sometimes I look at them and pretend they're pictures of me and not Honor. I'm sure the one he's sketching now will end up at the bottom of my drawer as well, because Honor doesn't appreciate the artistic side of him. Moby glances at me and covers his mouth with his hand, mumbling something intended for only me to hear. He always puts his hand flat over his mouth when he's telling someone a secret, rather than cupping his hand around his mouth. It's so adorable we don't have the heart to tell him we can never understand a word he's saying. But I don't have to understand him because I know exactly what he's asking for. I wink at him and grab the box of donuts from the top of the refrigerator. There are 2 left in the box, so I put one in my mouth and walk the other one to Moby. He takes the donut from my hand and immediately crawls under the table to eat it. I don't even have to tell him to go hide from his mother. He already knows that anything that tastes good to him is off-limits to Victoria.
You realize you're teaching him to hoard junk food, right?
Utah enters the kitchen in his usual holier-than-thou mood.
If he grows up to be morbidly obese, it's your fault.
I disagree with this theory, but I don't say anything to defend my actions. It would ruin my 3-day streak of not speaking. But despite my lack of a rebuttal, Utah is wrong. If Moby grows up to be morbidly obese, that's all on Victoria. She's eliminated entire food groups from his diet. She doesn't allow him to have sugar, carbs, gluten, or any ingredient that ends in os. The poor kid eats steel-cut oatmeal for breakfast every day without butter or sugar. That can't be good for him. At least I sneak him sweets in moderation. Utah walks past me, heading for his smoothie. He takes it from Honor's hand and leans in to give her a quick thank-you kiss on top of her head. He knows not to come near me with his cheerful sibling affection. If the proof weren't in our DNA, I would say that Utah and Honor seem more like identical twins than she and I do. They're the ones who finish each other's sentences, share inside jokes, and spend the most time together. Utah and I have nothing in common, other than being the only two people in the Voss family to know its deepest, darkest secret. But since it's something we've never once discussed since the day it happened, it's barely a common thread between us now. And we look nothing alike. Honor and I look more like our mother, or at least like she did when she was younger. Her hair used to be a more vibrant blonde, much like ours is now, but she hasn't seen the sun in so long, I've noticed that the color has dulled. Utah looks like our father, with sandy brown hair and pale skin. Honor and I also have a paler shade of skin, but it's not to the degree of Utah's. He has to wear sunscreen if he's going to be outside for more than half an hour, or he'll burn. I guess Honor and I lucked out because we tan fairly easily in the summer. Obi is just a mix of all of us. Sometimes he looks like our father, sometimes he looks like Victoria. But most of the time he reminds me of this bird off a Dawn dish soap commercial I saw last year. It's not a bad resemblance, it was a cute bird. Utah takes a seat and bends down to look under the table.
Morning, buddy. You excited about today?
Moby wipes sticky glaze from his mouth with his shirt sleeve and nods, yes.
How excited? Utah says.
So excited, Moby says, grinning from ear to ear.
How excited?
The most excited, Moby yells.
There's nothing significant about today worth being excited about. This exchange is a daily occurrence between Utah and Moby.
Utah says it's important to get kids pumped up for their day, even if there's nothing significant about it. He says it helps foster a positive neurological environment, whatever that's supposed to mean. Utah wants to be a teacher and already has his entire college schedule planned out. As soon as he graduates high school in 6 months, he has a 2-day weekend and then begins classes at the local university the following Monday. Honor also signed up to start classes 2 days after graduation. Me? I'm still debating on going to class today, much less college 6 months from now. It's unusual to have 3 siblings who are all seniors in high school at the same time. My mother gave birth to Utah in August and then got pregnant with Honor and me 1 month later. Apparently it's just a rumor that breastfeeding prevents a woman from ovulating. When it was time for Utah to start school, she and my father decided to hold him back a year so they could have us all in the same grade at the same time. No sense dealing with different schedules when you can have one schedule for all 3 of your children. I don't think they thought far enough in advance to consider having to pay for 3 college tuitions at the same time. Not that it would matter. My parents don't have the kind of money to pay 1 college tuition, let alone 3. Once we start college, it'll be student loans or nothing for me. Honor and Utah won't have to worry about tuition because, as it stands, they're several points ahead of anyone else in the class when it comes to vying for valedictorian and salutatorian. There's no question a Voss sibling will be in the top 2 spots in the class and will land the coveted scholarships that accompany the awards. It's merely a question of which one of them will come out the most victorious. My vote is on Utah, simply because he runs less of a risk of becoming preoccupied with the terminally ill between now and graduation. I'm not a competitive person by nature, so grades have never meant as much to me as they do to the 2 of them. I used to fall somewhere in the middle of the class when it comes to grade point average, but I'm sure my GPA has taken quite a hit in the past 2 weeks. I haven't been back to school since the day I left early and went to the town square. I might go back, but I'm more leaning toward not. Utah is moving out in a month or 2, but it probably won't affect his GPA. Utah isn't the type to party and let his grades slip. Besides, he'll probably still be here most of the time since he isn't going far. He's redoing the floors in our old house, the one located directly behind this one. As soon as he finishes them, he's moving over there. If anything, the peace and quiet will give him even more time to study and clean and iron his clothes. He has to be the most impeccably dressed high school senior I've ever encountered at a public school with no required uniform. Honestly, I'll be glad when he moves into our old house. There's been a lot of tension between us for a while now. I pour myself a cup of juice and sit at the table across from Sagan. He doesn't acknowledge me, but he does shield whatever he's drawing with his sporadically tattooed arm. I take note of a few new tattoos I haven't noticed yet. There's some sort of shield, a tiny lizard with one eye, or maybe it's winking. I would ask him what they mean, but I'd have to speak to him. I just keep my mouth shut and try to sneak a peek at whatever it is he's drawing. I lean forward and try to get a better look. His eyes dart up and meet mine. I ignore the flutter of energy his eye contact gives me and force an unwavering expression. He arches an eyebrow and picks up his sketchbook as he leans back against his chair. He's still looking at me as he gives his head a slow shake to let me know I'm not getting the privilege of watching him sketch. I don't want to see it anyway. His phone vibrates and he practically lunges for it. He flips it over and looks at the screen, but his face falls flat. He silences the call and flips his phone over. Now I'm curious who makes him so anxious to answer his phone if Honor is sitting right here. Sagan glances up at Honor and she's staring at him. There's a silent exchange between them, and knowing they probably have inside secrets burns a hole in my stomach. I move my attention to Moby, who is still hiding under the table. He's managed to get more of the donut on his face than inside his mouth. "One more?" he mutters with a mouthful. I shake my head. Moderation. Also, we don't have any more. Victoria enters the kitchen in a rush. "Moby, come get your oatmeal!" She yells this loud enough to spread across all quarters of the house, but if she'd pay closer attention to her child instead of her makeup, she'd notice he's already awake, dressed, and fed. Victoria grabs a knife from the drawer and a banana. She wipes the blade of the knife across her pink scrubs, judging its cleanliness or lack thereof. "Whose day was it to wash dishes yesterday?" None of us respond to her. We rarely do. Unless our father is in the room, Victoria is of little importance to us. "Well, whoever unloaded the dishwasher, make sure the dishes are clean before you put them away. These are disgusting." She puts the knife in the sink and pulls another knife out of the drawer. She glances across the kitchen at all her stepchildren sitting around the table. I'm the only one looking at her. She sighs and begins peeling the banana. I have no idea what my father sees in her. Sure, she's cute for her age, having just turned 35, a good 10 years younger than my mother. But that's the extent of Victoria's qualities. She's an overbearing mother to Moby. She takes her job as a nurse way too seriously. Not that being a nurse isn't a reputable career, but the issue with Victoria is she doesn't seem to know how to separate her work life from her home life. She's always in caregiver mode to Moby like he's ill, but he's a very viable 4-year-old. And she always wears pink scrubs, even though she's allowed to wear any color or pattern she wants. I think her pink scrubs annoy me more than anything else about her. I might even be more willing to forgive her for the atrocity she committed against my mother if she'd wear a different color just once. I remember the day she started wearing pink scrubs. I was 12, sitting at this very table. She had emerged from quarter 3, back when quarter 3 was shared by my father and ailing mother. She had been my mother's nurse for about 6 months, and I actually kind of liked her. Until that particular morning, anyway. My father had been sitting across from me reading the paper when he looked up at her and smiled.
"Pink looks really good on you, Victoria."
I know I was young, but even kids can recognize flirting, especially when that flirting only involves one of their 2 married parents. Victoria has only worn shades of pink scrubs since that day. I often wonder if their affair began before or after that flirtatious moment in the kitchen. Sometimes the curiosity consumes me so much, I want to ask them the exact hour they began ruining my mother's life. But that would mean we were discussing a secret out in the open, and we don't do that in this family. We keep our secrets buried deeper than the grave Victoria wishes my mother would go ahead and fall in. They kept the affair quiet for at least a year, long enough to realize my mother's cancer wasn't going to kill her after all, but not long enough to prevent Victoria from getting pregnant. My father was stuck between a rock and a hard place at that point. It didn't matter which decision he made, he'd still come out the asshole. On the one hand, he could choose not to abandon his wife, who had just beaten cancer, but if he chose his wife, that would mean he was abandoning his new pregnant mistress. It was so long ago, I'm not sure how he came about making the decision he made. I don't have much recollection of any fighting taking place between the adults. I do, however, remember when my mother and father discussed where his new wife and child would live. She suggested he move to our old home behind Dollar Voss and leave her here to manage us children. He refused on the grounds that she wasn't mentally or physically competent enough to manage us children without his help. And, sadly, he was right. My mother had been in a car accident when she was pregnant with my sister and me, and she never fully recovered. To us kids, she's the same person she's always been, considering we didn't know her before the accident. But we know she changed because of how our father references things. He would say, "Before the accident, when your mother could," or, "Before the accident, when we would take vacations," or, "Before the accident, when she wasn't so ill." He never said any of those things out of spite, I don't think. They were just matter of fact. There is the Victoria Voss before the accident, and the Victoria Voss we now have as a mother. If you don't count her bad back, her 2-year fight against brain cancer, a slight limp in her step, a severe social anxiety that's kept her in the basement for over 2 years, a few scars on her right arm, and her inability to make it through an entire day without at least 2 naps, she's relatively normal. We used to try to get her to leave the basement and interact with us all the time. The last time she left the basement was to attend Kirk's funeral, and that was only because Honor sobbed and begged her to come. But after that, when the first year of her seclusion came and went, and our mother seemed to be functioning just fine with her life in the basement, we had no choice but to accept it. With Utah, Honor, and me, she's checked on daily. My father still buys all her groceries, and Honor and I make sure her mini-kitchen is fully stocked. She doesn't have any bills because my father covers utilities on the whole house. The only issue that has come up in the past 2 years since she's been secluded is her health. Fortunately, my father found a doctor who does house calls if he's ever needed, and since she refuses to see a psychiatrist for her social phobia, we have no other choice but to accept it. For now. I have a feeling after all 3 of us kids are out of the house next year, Victoria is going to demand my mother move out. But that's not a battle anyone wants to confront prematurely, especially when my siblings and I will be the first to come to our mother's defense. Victoria has just resigned to pretending my mother doesn't exist, the same way my siblings and I pretend Victoria doesn't exist. We don't see the point in befriending a woman we despise simply because she's the mother of our little half-brother. Since the day Victoria entered our lives, our family hasn't been the same. And while we do hold our father accountable for half of our family issues, he is still required to love us, which makes him harder to blame than Victoria, who doesn't even like us. Victoria scoops up the bananas and layers them over the top of Moby's bowl of oatmeal. "Moby, come eat your breakfast." Moby crawls out from under the table and stands up. "I'm not hungry." He wipes glaze off his mouth with the sleeve of his shirt. There's no hiding that he just inhaled a donut, and there's no sense in trying to hide that I'm the one who gave it to him.
"Moby," Victoria says, taking him in, "what in the world is all over your..."
Here we go.
"Merritt, I told you not to give him donuts."
I look at Victoria innocently, just as my father walks into the room. She turns her attention to him, waving the knife in the air that she was just using to slice bananas. Merritt gave Moby a donut for breakfast. My father gently slides his fingers around her wrist and grabs the knife. He leans in and kisses her on the cheek and then sets the knife on the counter, finding me and his crowd of children.
Merritt, we talked about this. Do it again and you're grounded.
I nod, assuming that's the end of it. But Victoria doesn't stop there, because a donut for breakfast is the equivalent to Armageddon, and it deserves all the panic. You never ground them, she accuses. She grabs the bowl of oatmeal and walks it over to the trash. She angrily scoops the contents of the bowl into the trash. I've never seen you actually follow through with a single punishment, Barnaby. It's why they act like this. They, being my father's three oldest children. And it's the truth. He's full of empty threats and very little follow-through. That's my favorite thing about him.
Sweetie, lighten up. Maybe Merritt didn't know she wasn't supposed to give him a donut today.
Nothing irks Victoria more than when my father takes our side over hers. Of course Merritt knows not to give him a donut. She doesn't listen to me. None of them do. Victoria chucks the bowl in the sink and bends to pick up Moby. She sets him on the counter near the sink and wets a napkin to wipe donut remnants off his face. Moby, you cannot eat donuts. They are very bad for you. They make you sleepy, and when you're sleepy, you can't perform well in school. Never mind the fact that he's four and isn't even in real school yet. My father sips from his coffee cup and then reaches over to Moby and ruffles his hair.
Listen to your mother, buddy.
He carries his coffee and newspaper to the table, taking the seat next to me. He gives me a look that says he's not happy with me. I just stare at him with the hope that he demands I apologize or ask me why I broke one of Victoria's rules again. But he doesn't, which means my no-speaking streak is looking good for day four. I wonder if anyone will notice my taciturnity. Not that I'm giving anyone the silent treatment. I'm 17 years old, hardly a child, but I do feel invisible in this house most of the time, and I'm curious how long it will take before someone notices I haven't spoken out loud. I realize it's a bit passive-aggressive, but it's not like I'm doing it to prove a point to them. It's simply to prove a point to myself. I wonder if I can make it an entire week. I once read a quote that said, "Don't make your presence known. Make your absence felt." No one in this family notices my presence or my absence. They would all notice honors. But I was born second, which just makes me a faded copy of the original.
What's going on the marquee today, Utah?
My father asks. It's bad enough all the ex-parishioners of this church still hold a grudge against my father for buying this house, but the marquee digs the knife in even deeper. I'm sure the daily quotes that have nothing to do with Christianity get under people's skin. Yesterday's quote said, "Charles Darwin ate every animal he discovered." I had to Google that fact because it sounded too insane to be true. It's true.
"You'll see in 5 minutes," Utah says.
He downs the rest of his shake and pushes away from the table. "Wait," Honor says. "Maybe you should hold off on updating the marquee today. You know, out of respect." Utah stares blankly at Honor, which clues her in that none of us knows what she's talking about. She looks at my father. "Pastor Brian died last night." I immediately turn my attention to my father at that news. He rarely shows emotion, and I'm not sure what kind of emotion this will bring, but surely it'll be something. A tear? A smile? He stares stoically at Honor as he absorbs the news.
"He did?"
She nods. "Yeah, I saw it on Facebook this morning. Heart attack." My father leans back in his chair, gripping his coffee cup. He looks down at the cup.
"He's dead?"
Victoria puts a hand on my father's shoulder and says something to him, but I tune her out. Until this moment, I had forgotten all about Wolfgang showing up last night. I put my hand over my mouth because I suddenly want to tell them all about the dog showing up in the middle of the night, but I feel like I might choke up. What does it say about me that I didn't have any sort of reaction just now to the news of Pastor Brian's passing, but realizing his dog came back to the only other home he's ever known makes me want to tear up? Honor called me a sociopath once while we were in the middle of a fight. I'll make it a point to look up that word later. There might be some truth to that.
"I can't believe he's dead,"
my father says. He stands up, and Victoria's hand slides off his shoulder and down his back.
"He wasn't that much older than me."
Of course, that's what he's focused on. Pastor Brian's age. He's less concerned about the death of a man he's been warring with for years, and more concerned that he was close in age to someone who is old enough to fall over dead from a heart attack. Utah is still paused at the door. He looks like he's in a state of disbelief.
"I don't know what to do," he says. "If I don't acknowledge his passing on the marquee, people will accuse us of being insensitive. But if I acknowledge it, people will accuse us of being disingenuous."
What an odd thing to be worried about in this moment. Honor's boyfriend tears out his drawing and stares down at it.
"Sounds like you're screwed either way, so I'd just go with whatever you feel like going with."
He says all this without looking up from his drawing, but his words reach Utah anyway, because after a brief moment of pause, Utah walks out the front door toward the marquee. I'm confused by two things. One being the constant and repeated presence of Honor's boyfriend at our breakfast table. Two being the fact that everyone seems to know him so well that they're perfectly fine with him joining in on the family conversation. Shouldn't he be too nervous to speak? Especially around my father. He's only been hanging around for a couple of weeks now. Meeting his girlfriend's family seemed to sit really well with him. I hate it. I also hate that he doesn't seem like the person who talks a lot, but the few things he does say have more weight than if anyone else were to say them. Maybe that's part of the reason I've decided to go on a verbal strike. I'm tired of everything I say not having meaning to anyone. I'll just stop talking so that when I do talk, my words will count. Right now, it feels like any time I talk, my words circle right back into my mouth like a boomerang, and I'm forced to swallow them again. "What's a heart attack?" Moby asks. Victoria bends and begins to help Moby put on his jacket. "It's when your heart stops working and your body goes to sleep. But it only happens when you're an old, old man like Pastor Brian." "His body went to sleep?" Moby asks. Victoria nods. "For how long? When is he going to wake up?"
"Not for a long time."
"Is he going to get buried?"
"Yes,"
she says, sounding a bit annoyed with the natural curiosity of her four-year-old. She zips his jacket.
"Go get your shoes."
"But what happens when he wakes up? Will he be able to get out of the ground?" I smile, knowing how much Victoria hates telling Moby the truth. He asks all the normal questions about life, and Victoria makes up the most bizarre answers. She'll do anything to protect him from the truth. I once heard him ask her what the word sex meant. She told him it was a terrible TV show from the 80s and that he should never watch it. She places her hands on Moby's cheeks. "Yes, he can get out of the ground when he wakes up. They'll bury Pastor Brian with a cell phone so he can call them when it's time to dig him back up." Honor sputters laughter and spews juice everywhere. Utah hands her a napkin and whispers, "Does she think this is healthier than telling him the truth?" We're all watching this conversation with fascination. Victoria can sense it because even though she's failing miserably, she's giving it her best effort to put Moby's questions to rest. "Let's go find your backpack," she says, pulling on his hand. He stops following her right before they make it to the hallway. "What if his phone battery dies while his body is sleeping? Will he be stuck in the ground forever?" My father grabs Moby by the hand, sweeping in to rescue the desperate Victoria.
"Come on, buddy. Time to go."
Right when they round the corner to the hallway, I hear Moby say, Isn't it time for your body to sleep, Daddy? It's getting really old, too. Honor starts laughing, and I think her boyfriend does, too, but his laugh is quiet, and I don't want to look at him. I cover my mouth because I'm not sure if laughing out counts against my verbal strike. But Victoria's mothering skills are humorous at best. Victoria is staring at all of us with her hands on her hips, watching us laugh. Her face turns as pink as her scrubs, and she walks swiftly out of the room, headed toward quarter three. I would feel sorry for her if she didn't bring this on herself. Utah and Honor begin to pack up their things. I walk to the sink and pretend to busy myself, hoping they don't ask me if I'm going to school today. I usually take a different car than the two of them because they both stay after school, Honor for cheerleading practice and Utah for whatever it is Utah does after school. I'm not even sure. I go to my room, mostly to avoid looking at Honor's boyfriend, because every time I do, I feel a little bit of his mouth on mine from that day on the square. I wait in my room and listen for the front door to open and close, and even then I wait several more minutes. When the house is finally quiet and I'm certain he's gone, I open my bedroom door and slowly walk toward the kitchen to ensure the coast is clear. My mother is downstairs, but the chances of her coming out of the basement to ask why I've skipped school are less than the chances of the Cowboys beating the Packers tonight. Speaking of, I'm a little disappointed my father or Victoria didn't notice Jesus before they left. On my way into the kitchen, the marquee outside the window catches my attention. I squint to read the words Utah selected to display. There are more fake flamingos in the world than real ones. I sigh. A little disappointed in Utah. If it were me, I would have paid my respects to Pastor Brian. Either that, or I wouldn't have updated it at all. But to update it without acknowledging the death of the man who erected that very marquee seems a little, I don't know, like something people would expect from a boss. I don't like validating their negative perception of us. I glance in the living room and then the kitchen, wondering what I'm going to do with myself today. Another crossword puzzle? I'm getting really good at them. I sit down at the table with my half-completed book of crossword puzzles. I flip it to the puzzle I finished on Friday and start the next one. I'm on the third question across before the doubt begins to seep in. It's no big deal. This has been happening every day since I stopped going to school. A sense of panic rears its ugly head, making me question my choice. I'm still not quite certain why I stopped going. There wasn't a single catastrophic or embarrassing incident that influenced my decision, just a bunch of small ones that continued to pile up until they were hard to ignore. That, coupled with my ability to make choices without giving them a second thought. One minute I was at school, and the next minute I decided I'd rather be browsing antiques than learning about how terribly we lost the Battle of the Alamo. I like spontaneity. Maybe I like it because Utah hates it so much. There's something freeing about refusing to stress over stressful situations. No matter how much thought or time you put into a decision, you're still only going to be wrong or right. Besides, I've accrued more knowledge this week by doing these crossword puzzles than I probably could in my entire senior year attending high school. That's why I only do one puzzle a day. I don't want to get too intellectually ahead of Honor in Utah. It isn't until I finish the puzzle and close the book that I notice the sketch left on the table. It's placed upside down in front of the spot I was seated at this morning. I reach across the table, slide the sketch toward me, and flip it over. His drawings make no sense. What would possess him to draw a picture of someone swallowing a boat? I flip it over and look at the back of it. At the very bottom it reads, "If silence were a river, your tongue would be the boat." I flip the drawing back over and stare at it a moment, completely taken aback. Did he draw this for me? Was he the only one in this house to notice I haven't spoken since Friday? He actually noticed, I whisper. And then I immediately slap the drawing on the table and groan. I just ruined my no-speaking streak. Damn it!
Chapter 4 How long will this last? I ask the cashier, dropping the 50-pound bag of dog food onto the counter.
What kind of dog? She asks.
It's for a full-grown black lab.
Just one?
I nod.
Maybe a month, month and a half.
Oh, I was guessing a week.
I don't think he'll live with us that long.
She rings up the total and I pay with my father's debit card. He said to only use it in emergencies. I'm sure food is an emergency to Wolfgang.
You need help carrying it out?
Someone from behind me asks. No thanks, I say, taking my receipt. I turn around to face him. I only got the one bag.
What are you wearing?
I didn't mean to say that out loud, but I wasn't expecting to be met with the likes of the guy I'm staring at right now. Peeking out beneath his hat are sporadic pieces of red hair, too bright to be authentic. So bright it's almost offensive. His face is decent, a little imperfection here and there, but I didn't give it much notice because my eyes went straight to the kilt he's wearing. I guess the kilt itself isn't tripping me up as much as the clothes he chose to pair it with. He's wearing a basketball jersey and neon green Nikes. Interesting ensemble. The guy looks down at his outfit.
It's a basketball jersey, he says innocently.
You don't like Blake Griffin?
I shake my head. Sports aren't my thing. He sets what looks like a lifetime supply of beef jerky on the counter. I wrap both arms around the ginormous bag of dog food and head to my car. The car I drove here isn't specifically mine, but that's because my father never keeps a car long enough for any of us to claim ownership over it. Vehicles have always rotated in our driveway, and the only rule is that whichever person leaves the house first each day gets first pick. I think that's the true reason behind Utah's extreme punctuality. Last month, a faded red 1983 Ford EPX appeared in the driveway. It's such a terrible car, they stopped making them almost as quickly as they started. I think my father has been having trouble selling it because it's the longest any vehicle has lasted before it's been sold. And since I rarely leave the house on time, this unfortunate Ford has been driven more by me than the rest of the family put together. I place the bag of dog food in the trunk, and am about to open my front door when Kilt Guy appears out of nowhere. He's chewing on a piece of beef jerky, assessing my car like he's about to steal it. He walks toward the front of the car and taps his neon green Nike against the front tire twice.
Think you can give me a ride?
He looks at me and leans against the car. Despite the kilt, there's no trace of a Scottish accent. There's also no trace of a Texas accent either, but when he said the word you just now, he sounded a tad British.
What kind of accent is that? I ask.
I open my front door and stand behind it to put a barrier between us. He looks harmless, but I don't like his confidence. I need to shield myself from it. Overly confident people should never be trusted. He shrugs.
I'm from all over, he says.
But he says over with an Australian twang.
Over? Are you Australian?
Never been there, he says.
What kind of car is this?
He walks to the rear of the car to read the make and model.
Ford EPX, they're extinct, I tell him. Where do you need a ride to?
He's back from the rear of the car, but now he's standing on the same side of the door as me.
My sister's house. It's a few miles east of here.
I give him another once over. I'm aware of how stupid it is to give a complete stranger a ride, especially a stranger in a kilt who can't seem to nail his own accent. Everything about him screams unstable. But my spontaneity and refusal to weigh the consequences of my decisions are my two favorite things about me.
Sure, I'm headed east.
I sit in the driver's seat and shut my door.
He grins at me through the window and runs around to the passenger side. I have to lean across the seat to unlock the door so that he can open it. Give me a second to grab my things. He takes off in a sprint across the parking lot until he reaches a pile of stuff propped next to the front entrance of the store. He grabs the backpack and throws it over his shoulder, then a 30-gallon black trash bag and a small suitcase on wheels. I agreed to give him a ride, not him and everything he ever owned. I pop the trunk and wait for him to finish loading his belongings. When he's back inside the car, he puts on his seatbelt and smiles at me. Ready. Are you homeless? Define homeless, he says. A person without a home. His eyes narrow in thought. Define home. I shake my head. You are the strangest person I've ever met. I crank the car and put it in reverse. You obviously haven't met very many people. What's your name? Merritt. I'm Luck. I shoot him a quick glance before pulling out onto the highway. Luck? Is that a nickname?
Nope.
He opens his container of beef jerky and offers me a piece. I shake my head.
You a vegetarian or something?
No, I say. I just don't want any beef jerky.
I have granola bars in my suitcase.
I'm not hungry.
You thirsty?
Why? You don't even have a drink to offer me if I am.
I was going to suggest a drive-thru, Luck says. Are you thirsty?
No.
How old are you?
I'm starting to regret my spontaneity. 17.
Why aren't you in school right now? Is today a holiday?
No, I'm finished with high school. It's not a lie. Finished and completed are two different things.
I'm 20,
he says, moving his attention out his window. His knee is bouncing up and down, and he's tapping the fingers of his right hand on his leg. All his fidgeting has me questioning my decision to give him a ride to his sister's house. I make a mental note to look at his pupils if he faces me again. It would be my luck to pick up a random stranger who is coming down from a high.
How many dogs do you have?
He's still staring out the window as he asks me this. None. He faces me and arches a brow. I use the opportunity to assess his pupils. Normal.
Why are you buying dog food if you don't have dogs?
It's for a dog at my house, but he's not our dog.
Are you dog sitting?
No.
Did you steal him?
No.
What kind of dog is it?
Black Lab. He grins. I like Black Labs.
Where do you live?
I must make a face that indicates what I think of that invasive question because he immediately responds,
I didn't mean your exact address. I just meant in relation to where I'm going.
I don't know. I don't know where you're going.
To my sister's house.
Where does your sister live? He shrugs.
This way,
he says, pointing in the direction we're going. He pulls his phone out of his pocket.
I have a picture of her house.
You don't know her address? He shakes his head.
No, but if you can just drop me off somewhere in the general area, I can ask around.
General area of where?
The general area of my sister's house.
I press my hand against my forehead. I've known this guy all of 5 minutes, and I'm already overwhelmed. I have no idea if I like him or if I can't stand him. He's a little bit fascinating, but in a slightly annoying sense. He's probably one of those people that can only be tolerated in spurts, kind of like a thunderstorm. They're fun if they only appear when you're in the mood for one, but if they show up when they aren't wanted, like at an outdoor wedding, they ruin everything.
How did you finish school already? Are you one of those people that's better at everything than everyone else? Like Adam Levine? You probably play guitar.
What does that even mean?
No, I don't play guitar. And I'm not better at everything.
I'm not as good at asking questions as you.
You're also not good at answering them.
Is he seriously insulting my conversation skills? I've answered every question you've asked.
Not in the way you're supposed to answer questions.
There's another way to answer questions other than giving the correct answer?
He nods.
You're giving short answers like you aren't interested in having a conversation. It should be a two-man sport, like a ping-pong match. But with you, it feels more like bowling, just going one way down the lane.
I laugh.
You should learn social cues. If someone is answering your questions like they don't want to answer them, maybe you should stop asking questions.
He stares at me a moment and then opens his container of beef jerky again.
You want a piece yet?
No, I say again, growing more agitated with him by the second.
Are you dumb? Like, are you a legit stupid person?
He closes his container and sets it on the floor between his legs.
No. I'm actually very smart.
What's your issue, then? Are you on drugs?
He laughs.
Not any illegal ones.
He's smiling at me, taking this entire conversation in stride. This is normal for him? He's completely at ease. It makes me wonder what other kind of people he's encountered in his life for him to think what's happening right now is normal.
I exit the highway and decide the best course of action would be to drop him off at the only gas station in our town.
You got a boyfriend, Merritt?
I shake my head.
Girlfriend?
I shake my head again.
Well, is there anyone you find intriguing?
Are you hitting on me, or is this just you asking questions?
I'm not actively hitting on you, but that's not to say I wouldn't. You're cute. But right now I'm just making conversation. Ping pong.
I blow out a frustrated rush of air.
You're about to hit a turkey, he says, matter of fact.
I slam on my brakes. Why would there be a turkey on this road? I scan the road in front and around us, but see nothing.
There's no turkey.
I meant metaphorically.
What the hell?
Never tell a driver they're about to hit something metaphorically. Jesus Christ!
I let off the brake until the car starts moving again.
It's a bowling term. Three strikes is a turkey.
I am so lost.
He sits up straighter and pulls his leg up in his seat so that he can face me.
Conversation should be like ping pong, he repeats.
But conversation with you is like bowling. It's a long, one-way lane. Three strikes and bowling is a turkey. And since you aren't answering my questions, I used turkey as an analogy to describe your lack of...
Okay, I say, holding up a hand to shut him up.
I get it. Yes, there's a guy. Anything else you want to know before you start over-explaining metaphorical roadkill again?
I can already sense his excitement that I'm agreeing to participate in his conversation, even if it is just to shut him up.
Does he know you like him?
He asks.
I shake my head.
Does he like you?
I shake my head again.
Is he out of your league?
No, I say immediately. That's so rude.
But even though his question was rude, it does give me pause. When I first saw Sagan at the antique store, I had a quiet fear that he was out of my league. But when I found out he was dating Honor, it never even crossed my mind that she was out of his league. I hate that I might have thought she deserved him more than I did.
Why isn't he your boyfriend?
I grip the steering wheel. I'm a mile away from the gas station. One more stop sign and I can drop him off.
Don't hit the metaphorical turkey, he says.
Why aren't you dating this fellow you find intriguing?
Fellow?
He seriously just referred to another guy as a fellow, and his turkey metaphor doesn't even make sense.
You use analogies wrong.
Don't avoid the question, he says. Why aren't you and this guy dating?
I sigh.
He's my sister's boyfriend.
The words are barely out of my mouth before Luck starts laughing.
Your sister? Holy crap, Merritt, what a terrible thing to do!
I give him the side eye.
Does he think I don't realize how terrible it is to be attracted to my sister's boyfriend?
Does your sister know you like him?
Of course not, and she never will.
I motion toward his phone. Let me see the picture of your sister's house. I might know where it is. I'm more eager than ever to drop him off now. Luck scrolls through the pictures on his phone. Right when I get to the stop sign, he hands me his phone. You've got to be kidding me. I'm being pranked, right? I immediately throw the car in park. I zoom in on the picture of Victoria standing in front of Dollar Voss. The picture looks a couple of years old because the white picket fence my dad put up last year isn't in this picture. Looks like it might have been a church at some point, Luck says. Victoria is your sister? He perks up. You know her? I hand him back his phone and grip the steering wheel. I press my forehead against it. 5 seconds later, a car behind us honks. I look in my rearview mirror, and the guy behind us holds up his hands in frustration. I put the car in drive. Yes, I know her. You know where she lives? Yep. Luck faces forward again. Good, he says. That's good. He starts tapping his fingers on his leg again. And you're taking me to her house? Right now? He seems nervous again. Isn't that where you want to go? He nods, but even his nod seems unsure. Does your sister know you're coming? He shrugs his shoulders as he stares out the passenger window. There's not really a correct answer to that question. Actually, there are two potential correct answers, yes and no. She may not be expecting me today, but she can't abandon me without expecting me to show back up at some point. I had no idea Victoria had a brother. I'm not so sure my father knows Victoria has a brother, and he's so different. Nothing like Victoria. I turn onto our road and then pull into our driveway. I put the car in park. Luck is staring at the house, still tapping his leg and bouncing his knee, but not making an effort to get out of the car. Why does she live in a church? He pronounces church without the R. Church. All of his annoying confidence is gone, replaced by an equally annoying amount of vulnerability. He swallows and then reaches to the floorboard to pick up his container of beef jerky. Thanks for the ride, Merritt. He puts his hand on the door and glances back at me. We should be friends while I'm in town. You want to exchange numbers? I shake my head and open my door. That won't be necessary. I pop the trunk and get out of the car. I can get my own stuff, he says. You don't have to help. I open the trunk. I'm not. I'm getting my dog food. I struggle to pull the bag out from beneath all of Luck's belongings. Once I have a secure grip on it, I head for the front door. Why are you taking your dog food to my sister's house? When I don't stop to answer him, he starts following me. Merritt! He reaches me just as I stick a key in the front door. When it unlocks, I face him. He's still staring at the key in the door. Your sister is married to my father. I wait for him to absorb that information. When he does, he takes a step back and tilts his head. You live here? With my sister? I nod. She's my stepmother. He scratches his chin. So that makes me your uncle. Step-uncle. I walk through the front door and toss the bag of dog food onto the floor. Luck stands in the doorway as he runs a hand through his hair and then grips the back of his neck. I already pictured you naked, he mutters. Now would be a good time to stop doing that. Luck glances back to the car and then peeks his head inside the house. Is my sister home right now? He whispers. She doesn't get back for a couple of hours. Get your stuff, and I'll show you where to put it. While he heads back to the car, I drag the dog food through the kitchen and set the bag next to the back door. I find a couple of old bowls and fill them with water and food, then take them out back.
Wolfgang is halfway out of the doghouse, lying on his stomach. His ears perk up when he hears the back door shut, but he doesn't move. His ears go limp again when he sees me. He just watches as I set the bowls down next to his doghouse. He makes no move to devour.